You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
A trigger warning for all you listeners out there. Please be advised that this piece has brief mentions of sexual violence, so discretion is advised. This piece lasts about 10 minutes.
Crimes go unreported for a variety of reasons. So it's not a simple relationship between observing a crime or being a victim of crime and reporting it. So some crimes have very high reporting rates. So for example, homicides or motor vehicle thefts, really any crime that involves filing an insurance report so that you can recover the loss, because people are motivated financially to file an insurance claim. One of the requirements for that is often to file a police report if you're claiming that your property was damaged or lost as a product of crime. And so things like motor vehicle theft have very, very high reporting rates, whereas a lot of other crimes, for example, domestic abuse, a lot of sexual offenses, we know that these are dramatically underreported in official statistics. So there's a few ways that criminologists try and determine how much crime is out there. One mechanism that we use are these official crime statistics. But another way we can look at the same issue is by talking to people about their experiences as victims. Through measures of victimhood, we can, for example, know that the levels of, say, sexual assault are much higher in victim studies than they are in official crime statistics. We also can learn about rates of crime through self-report, asking people to describe the offenses that they themselves have committed, whether or not they've been arrested or convicted for it. And using those three measures, official statistics and victim statistics and self-report statistics, we can sort of triangulate in and make an estimate of how much real crime might be out there. You mentioned the armed robberies and dairies. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why someone might not report that. And one of the obvious ones is fear, that if you are a shopper in a dairy at the time that someone comes in with a weapon and you decide you want to be a good citizen and report the crime, that may involve your filing a sworn police statement and you may be called upon to testify in open court. And so for people who are frightened of the fear of retaliation is a real concern for a lot of people. Another issue can be that if I'm a customer in a dairy and I see something like that happen, my assumption, a strong assumption, would be that the store owner would make the report. It wouldn't be on my shoulders to file a formal claim of this kind. And yet there may be a lot of reasons why a store owner might choose not to report, even though there's a loss of some stock in their inventory. Either they know the person and they don't want to get them into trouble, which could happen, or they are afraid of retaliation, either vandalism or property damage or violence, or they don't want to make the time to file the report and to go through the paperwork and to appear in court if that's necessary. And maybe it's easier in a lot of cases just to write it off as a business loss.
The area commander for Auckland's downtown has said that a quote-unquote boots on the ground approach is what they will favour. Is a police presence the most effective deterrent for crime, or should we be looking at more preventative measures?
Some of the best work that I've seen on deterrence shows that, in fact, the criminal justice system as a collective enterprise actually has a pretty strong deterrent effect on the prevention of criminal activity. And criminologists talk about areas called hotspots, where we know that there are frequent, repeated kinds of offending that take place with predictable frequency. And if you can find these kind of predictable patterns, there is a value, potentially, in deploying officers to have a physical presence in that place at those times. But it does take time for the physical presence of law enforcement officers to be recognized by the people you are trying to deter. And so there is a delay, a lag, as people recognize that there is an increased police presence. And the flip side of that is you can discontinue a police presence, and there will be some ongoing deterrent effects. But there's also a concern that what you can wind up doing is you can simply displace a problem from one place to another place. So if there are a lot of police officers crawling up and down Queen Street every Thursday, it may be oppressive enough that the people you are trying to deter from crime simply relocate, and you may wind up recreating the problem somewhere else. There's probably some advantage in terms of boots on the ground, but it's a relatively inefficient way of addressing problems. We probably could realize equal or better results through a lot of the prevention mechanisms that you were mentioning earlier. To the extent that these offenses take place because of strains that people are under, either psychological strain, and we can imagine a lot of different kinds of strains as a consequence of COVID and of lockdowns and of financial pressures that have created for a lot of people, or the sort of density of people, that if you have a lot of people who are more prone to engaging in active crimes. And that, so there you can think about people with addiction issues, young people, especially young males, seem to engage in acts of crime and delinquency at higher rates than older adults or females of the same age. And as you sort of create this, there's a whole literature around a way of thinking about predicting crime called routine activities theory. Routine activities theory says what you need for a crime to take place is you need three things to come together in place and in time. You need a motivated offender, you need a suitable target, and the absence of a capable guardian. One way to think about that is if you put a lot of boots on the ground, a lot of uniformed officers driving around, then that does operate as a capable guardian. But again, you would need a police force that is implausible in number to successfully patrol all of the areas of Auckland known to be hotspots. It may be better to think about ways of alleviating some of those strains so that our offenders are less motivated to be offenders.
So keeping the concept of displacement in mind and the numbers that are needed to make a police presence truly effective in achieving safety, people are calling for the re-establishment of the downtown police station that was closed in 2013 in Auckland Central. Would this help?
It would make reporting a little easier for people that were in the Auckland area. But what it would do probably more productively is it would potentially reduce the response time if police officers have to respond to issues within the CBD, and especially for things where you're hoping to interrupt and to catch a crime during its commission, you would have a much better chance at doing that. And that may increase the likelihood of apprehending perpetrators. So it would probably have some advantages. But that being said, it is, I think, also possible to mobilize an existing police force without having a physical office in the CBD. You could still have a very dynamic present police force in the Auckland CBD, even without having a station there.
Research and focus groups have identified safety in the central city as being a priority for our community, and it has been the focus of many mayoral campaigns in the past. If police presence isn't the gold standard, overall, in your opinion, what is the best strategy for achieving safety or perceived safety long term?
It's a hard question, so I'll give you a weaselly answer. I mean, some of the best research that I've seen on crime prevention suggests that our best medicine is equality, is democracy, is a level playing field between people. That where we start to see higher levels of offending is when we see greater and greater inequalities in society. And again, for lots of kind of direct reasons. So you can think of the person living in the ghetto in the shadow of the palatial homes on the street next door. But it's often through less direct mechanisms. So through this kind of strain that I mentioned earlier, or through propagation of a criminogenic culture, a culture where being tough or being in fights or outwitting the law becomes a desirable trait. So the sort of macro level literature suggests probably the best thing we can do is to create as much equality as possible socially, that we can redistribute wealth so that those who are most vulnerable are aided most by those who are most in a position to assist them. That's probably the very best thing that we could do. But that is a large endeavor that's much bigger than deploying boots on the ground in the Auckland CBD, much bigger than treating this as an individual level problem of bad behavior. It means acknowledging it as a structural problem, as a social problem, as a political problem, and looking for solutions on those levels than trying to stop an individual with the presence of a police officer.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.